People say I'm no good, but they never, never do they say why their world is so mixed up or how it got that way. They all look at me and they frown. Do I really look so strange? If they really dug themselves, I know they want to change.
And yes, this is Wednesday Talk Radio here, still in our membership drive. Hope you've supported us, and if you haven't, that you will. During this hour, even, we'll be talking to you about that. But we have a extra special guest on who will be talking about the man behind the voice in that song. Did you guess it? If you did, you get a prize of some sort. Anyway, that was, that was Charles Manson singing People Say I'm No Good. It's ironic in so many ways. And the author of Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA and the Secret History of the 60s, is with us right now. His book, 30 Years in the Making. He started out thinking he was just going to be writing an article. In fact, he was reluctant to even agree to write in that article. But the publisher convinced him, and then that led on, a 20-year odyssey. It was supposed to be a 30th anniversary piece. Now the book has become a 50th anniversary book, 50 years August since the grisly murders in Hollywood that became arguably certainly at that time, the most notorious murder case in U.S. history. Manson himself became a legendary, mythic figure and the object of much obsessive curiosity, which our author Tom O'Neill was also very reluctant to get into. But he'll be talking about all that and more. Good morning, Tom. Hello, Tom. We don't have Tom.
Oh, you do? Hello?
Oh, there you go. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Sorry about that.
No worries. So I guess the first question it'll kind of get us all started. So, you know, after 50 years, I'm sure you've gotten this and many of the questions I'll be asking you, but why should people be, you know, why should people care about this case after all this time?
Well, you know, it was a pretty important case culturally, historically. It kind of, for all intents and purposes, ended the 60s. It literally happened in August of 69, and the family was identified as suspects in these murders in the first week of December, you know, the last few weeks of the decade. And it kind of caused a paradigm shift. All of a sudden, people looked at hippies differently, you know, with fear. And also, you know, parents were always concerned about kids living communally, free love, LSD, drug experimentation. But all of a sudden, you saw what was probably the worst nightmare of every parent, of what could happen to their kids, that they would turn into these zombies that would do, you know, the most horrific thing in the world, including stabbing a 8.5 month pregnant woman to death while she pleaded for the life of her unborn baby. So it's important that way. It's also important, in my own opinion, because I don't feel like we were ever told the truth about it. And my book tries to do a better job of putting a picture out there of what really happened and how and why.
Yeah, and of course, there may certainly be some people who actually either don't know much about who Charles Manson was or don't know the details of the actual murders. Maybe just give us a really quick thumbnail sketch of mm-hmm. of what led up to and the killings themselves.
Well, Manson was released from prison in 67. to Los Angeles. He immediately violated his parole by moving to San Francisco without permission. Rather than send him back to prison, as would have happened under normal circumstances, they assigned him to a parole officer there. And during the next 9 months or so, he built this group of following of mostly young women who believed that he was the second coming of Christ and Satan rolled into one. He migrated with these followers down to Los Angeles in the beginning of 68 and moved on to a commune at a old Western movie ranch called the Spawn Ranch. And within about a year and a half, this group grew to about 30 or 40 people. It was always changing. But by August of 69, Manson, in the official version, was prophesizing a race war, saying that he had received messages from the Beatles through the lyrics of the White Album, telling him that there was going to be this apocalypse, world-ending race war. But he decided it wasn't happening fast enough, and he wanted to trigger it. Again, this is the official version that the prosecutor laid out to the jury, and then later in his best-selling book, Helter Skelter. So what he did was he sent four or five of his followers out over two nights with orders to kill these people who were complete strangers to them as, you know, brutally as possible, and leave signs implicating the Black Panthers. He believed that that would create a kind of a backlash against not only the Black Panthers, but the Black race by white police and law enforcement, causing the Blacks then to have a revolt. And as he told his followers in the official version, during that race war, he had a place to hide them in a bottomless pit in the desert. And when the race war was over, the Blacks would have slaughtered all the whites on the planet Earth, and he and his followers would emerge from the hole, subjugate the Blacks, and then start repopulating the planet with their perfect offspring. And he called this Helter Skelter, which he took that name from the Beatles song.
Maybe it sounds like he was maybe reading too much Scientology or something.
Scientology, he was reading Heinlein, Stranger in a Strange Land, or having that stuff read to him, because there's a lot of evidence that he was barely literate, but he was being influenced by someone and something, and that's the motive for why these otherwise senseless murders occurred, according to Vince Pugliosi, the prosecutor, and that's kind of the story that's remained for 50 years. And what I did in my book, or tried to do, and I think as you said in your introduction, it wasn't what I set out to do, but I started seeing the official version fall apart when I started getting access first to interview subjects, people who testified and participated in the trial, but had never talked to a journalist before. And then later I was able to back it up with documents I obtained. And that's why it took so long. You know, it took years to get into some of these files and archives, particularly the Los Angeles DA's office, the sheriff's office, entire file of the case from a retired LAPD officer who, you know, was trying to sell it to me for 5 or 6 years and then finally agreed to let me look at it because I think he was so tired of me pestering him. and once I started getting that stuff, the whole version that Pugliosi presented kind of crumbled.
And, of course, Vincent Pugliosi, the prosecutor who wrote the book Helter Skelter and sort of built his post-prosecutorial career on that entire case. It seemed like he was sort of conscious of that at the time. I think you say that in your book. But a very extremely problematic figure that you kind of dissect in a lot of ways. And you get to talk to him, sort of do a dance with him, and then become, you know, kind of mortal enemies once he sees what you're actually onto mm-hmm. him. And one of the first people who really got as onto him as you did. Anyway, Pugliosi was, yes, a very I forgot where I was going with that, but so
he becomes a nemesis kind of me in the book, where battling through the whole book, me for information, him to suppress and keep me from publishing what I found out.
Exactly. And
unfortunately, he passed away about 3-4 years ago, and I really wanted him to be alive when the book came out so he could answer to all this, you know, to people besides myself. And unfortunately, he's not here to do that. A lot of people think I waited until he died to publish the book, which is hardly the case. I waited because the first publisher pulled the plug on it and then sued me for a return of the advance. It wasn't until that was settled, and that was the period that Vince died, that I was able to get a new publisher and get the book out this year.
Well, we're going to have to take a break, as I said. You did mention the Spahn Ranch. I want to ask you a little bit about that new film, Tarantino film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Okay.
See what you think about that. There's a new book about MK Ultra, which figures prominently in your book. We'll talk about all that and more, as I said. I mentioned this to Tom when I reached out to him for the interview. That I said I think it's been months, if not possibly years, since I've actually had such a page turner of a book. I actually stayed up well into the wee hours of the morning a couple nights reading this book. It's a hefty book. It's 450 pages plus footnotes and such, but it's every page has a new revelation. And the story of it's one of those books where he's telling his story about how he came to write this book and how he got involved in the story, and it's both parallel tracks and all the interweaving figures and stuff. Anyway, it's really amazing. Do yourself a favor and get a copy of this book. I really encourage you. Plus, it really does reveal a whole aspects of, you know, I've been really fascinated. To me, it's a tragedy the way the 60s came to an end, and, you know, with not romanticizing it, but, you know, there was a lot of stuff that was developing, a lot of challenges to the status quo, a lot of, you know, alternative lifestyles, which the hippies did actually represent. And it was kind of nipped in the bud, both by internal contradictions and by state repression, which Tom talks about this, the COINTELPRO. Anyway, we'll you know, edge up as close as we can to what Tom really thinks happened. I know he doesn't like that question, but you say you build a circumstantial case around, you know, all the different threads and people involved that led to the terrible tragedy and its aftermath. So yeah, before we'll get into the Spahn Ranch and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but I want to get to the meat of these questions. The tantalizing MK Ultra. Talk about some of the shadowy figures that you do more than any other researcher in really getting to who these people were, where they were, what they did. And I'll just list three: Jolly West, Reeve Whitson, and Roger Smith. Maybe take them in order.
Jolly West, was that the first one?
It's fine.
Yeah, Jolly West was a pretty internationally respected psychiatric researcher, academic, doctor, who worked first in the military. His first kind of claim to fame was when pilots were captured in the Korean War in the early first couple of years of the 50s, and started making confessions while they were in custody in Korea to having sprayed biological weapons and germs on crops and communities, which was against the international codes. The United States decided or declared that these guys were victims of communist brainwashing techniques, that there was a new drug named LSD that the Soviets and the Chinese and the North Koreans used to extract these false confessions. When the pilots were returned to the United States, a team of five psychiatrists was assigned to kind of deprogram them, and those psychiatrists consisted of Jolly West and four other pretty well-known people. West and the other doctors decided that they weren't brainwashed, but that they were basically through sleep deprivation, isolation, all kinds of abuse, just were doing whatever they were told to say secretly, they did believe they were brainwashed, and they wanted to know how to use that technology for our side. And at that point, the CIA started something called the MKUltra program. And it was designed or implemented to try to create, ultimately, programmed assassins, people who could be brainwashed into deciding they had to kill someone and be amnesic of who had them do it. There's a famous movie, The Manchurian Candidate, that was based on all of this. Somehow this fiction author had access to this information before the public did, because that book came out, I think, in 62. What we learned about it, we being the American public, didn't happen until the early 70s when Seymour Hersh, the famous journalist who was then working for the New York Times, first reported it on the front page of the paper. And he wrote about, in his report, he identified West as one of the subcontracted MKUltra scientists. West denied it, and denied it until he died in 1999, went to his grave saying he had been approached but wouldn't work with him and never believed in it. What I found by getting access to his private papers, and I'm sure he accidentally left these documents in his, I think it was 160 boxes of documents from his academic office, were correspondence between him and the head of the MKUltra program, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, who you mentioned a book was just written about him by a New York Times reporter named Kinzer. It was published a couple of weeks ago. Dr. Gottlieb was the mad scientist behind this really Nazi-like program where they were giving drugs to prisoners, patients in hospitals, and people that they lured to what they called safe houses in American cities like Los Angeles, New York, and San Francisco without their consent or knowledge, trying to see how they could manipulate them to do certain things. And West was a big part of this program. And I have the letters between him and the doctor outlining not just what they're going to do to their patients and how, but how they're going to hide it. When he began working for MKUltra in 53, he was at Lackland Air Force Base. He ran the psychiatric hospital there. And he continued when he moved over to Oklahoma University, where he ran their psychiatric department, and then on to UCLA in 1969. And the reason he figures into this story is in 1967 or 66, he took a sabbatical from University of Oklahoma, went to the Hate, went to Stanford, and was supposed to be doing a book on psychosis and personality disorder. He abandoned that in the spring of 67 when he became aware of this influx of teenagers and young people who were kind of migrating from all over the country to the Hate to become part of what became the Summer of Love in 1967. He wanted to study LSD. This is his official version, was he wanted to study LSD's effects on youth. And what people didn't know was he was secretly working for MKUltra at the time, and their objectives weren't just to study the effects, but to see how they could get people to do things against their moral code, to change their ideologies, et cetera, et cetera. So he went to the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic, which opened in June of 67, to recruit subjects for his studies. He had a safe house a couple blocks away, which he called a Haight-Ashbury project, where he had hippies or young kids kind of diverted there, and they would crash and use LSD, and he had people studying and observing them. Well, the problem with all this is his objective and what he reported to the CIA was he had successfully learned how to replace true memories with false memories without a subject's awareness. In other words, they'd be amnesic of this. That was in 1955. So during the same period of the summer of 67, when he was doing this research and recruiting hippies, well, one of the most prominent groups that was coming into the clinic every day was Manson and about six or seven of his burgeoning family, which was all women at that point, mostly late teens, early 20s, and they were going in to be treated for STDs and pregnancies and whatnot. And then the second person you mentioned, Manson's federal parole officer, Roger Smith, he was doing drug research too at the clinic. He was studying amphetamine.
Well, let me stop you right there, because this story is getting getting stranger and thicker as you go along, bringing in all these figures. And we do have to take another break. We will go into his parole officer, Roger Smith, and the and how Manson and his, quote, family were protected in an amazing number of ways, committing crimes, parole violations, and they all seem to continue to get off scot-free, and that leading up to the murders. But right now, once again, we appeal to you, our listeners. Yeah, I mean, this is just such an incredible story, and you really, really do have to read the book. I can't, if you think you're going to get the, you know, the gist of the story and that's enough through this interview, or I heard you on 1A on NPR, Tom. I thought that was a really excellent interview.
Oh, thank you.
And, but you're just not, you're not going to get the full story, no matter how much he tells you about these details. It's just such a rich, rich story and really spine tingling. I mean, if you think about what actually came down, you know, not just the people's, you know, the people's lives who were lost, those, you know, families and lives that were ruined, the people around them, the fear that was created in the Hollywood community, fear in, you know, the and just people not even knowing where it came from. I bet hitchhiking became difficult. That's something I've thought about.
That's what I was told,
yeah. I mean, these are major cultural shifts that were happening. And so we're trying to lead you up to a more of an understanding of how that all came about. And we heard some about Jolly West, the MK Ultra operative. We're going to maybe hear more about him. And you started to get to Roger Smith, his parole officer, who wasn't just a parole officer. It's more.
Yeah, he was studying criminology and drugs at Berkeley at the time, and was part of something called the San Francisco Project, which was a specialized program run by the federal government to try to determine recidivism rates of recently paroled prisoners, which is what Manson was. So all of this stuff was never reported before, but there was even closer scrutiny of Manson's activity during this time because he was part of this research program. And Roger was very lenient with Manson. And Manson violated his parole when he first moved from Los Angeles to San Francisco. And then about, I guess, a month later or 2 months later, he was arrested and convicted of what was originally a felony charge. It was reduced to a misdemeanor of interfering with a police officer who was trying to take a young girl away from him. And that should have sent him back to prison. Again, he was arrested several times during the next year, and all during this period, he was going to the clinic, you know, regularly, and he actually started seeing Roger at the clinic because Roger was preparing to do an amphetamine study that began in early 68. So the clinic was kind of a petri dish of who knows what, because there's really no record of what the MKUltra did, except for the documents I found. Most of the other stuff is all financial. And Manson emerged from that place in the fall of 67 with this following and migrated down to Los Angeles. And then the rest is history, what happened there and what happened to the image of the hippies. And even the whole left-wing movement really took a blow after these horrific murders.
Well, you know, so a strange. There's so many strange footnotes to the story. One strange footnote is how some of the, you know, some of the radical left leaders actually seemed to be cheerleading Manson. I thought that was kind of weird.
Bernadette Dorn had a famous announcement about something about killing piggies, and there should be more. You know, right on Charlie or something like that.
I guess the enemy of my enemy or enemy of my enemy is my friend, or anyway.
Yeah. Sure.
That's not the first time in history that sort of thing has happened. I'm sure Bernadine Dorn has long since repented that among other things. Yes. But anyway, that's just such a sordid history. I want to talk about we're talking about his parole violations, and not just him, but a lot of his family members got embroiled in various drug schemes and other things, and got arrested and got let off very mysteriously. Mm-hmm. due to the intervention of this Roger Smith, who was sort of a super parole officer, and seemed to, at a certain point, Manson was his only client. Is that right?
By the end, yeah. And five of the women, Manson, once they had relocated to L.A. in kind of the early summer of 68, and actually Roger Smith was removed by the office as his federal parole officer, and Manson got a new one down in L.A., but for a period he had no parole supervision. Anyway, when he was down in L.A., he sent five of the women to the Mendocino area to recruit new people for the group, and they all got arrested because they two or three teenage boys with acid, and one of them turned out to be a sheriff's deputy's kid who went running home into his parents' house and said his legs were melting. And they went and rounded them up, and they were charged with, among other things, contributing to the delinquency of minors. And they were...
We're getting some feedback from your phone. I don't know what that's about.
Oh, is it my phone? Sorry about
or
that.
Maybe it's... Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Anyway.
Hello?
It's good now. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Hello? No, you're fine now.
Yeah, I think somebody else is also
on the air. Okay.
Well, I'm trying to get on the air.
Oh, okay. I see. We've got a caller. I was trying to signal my engineer to wait 5 minutes for the caller because we're going to a break. But yeah, go ahead, caller. Ask your question.
Hi. So yeah, I just wanted to fill in the Bernadine Dorn's disgusting. I believe sort of she and Dallaire's were acknowledged Maoists, and this somehow fits in with a certain bloodthirsty tradition there. Anyway, what she actually said was free the take eight.
Okay.
Yeah, dig it. They took a fork and stuck it in those pigs.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. Well, that's it. Yeah.
Thank you for that.
And I had occasion to meet Dallaire, who's is wildly charming, and a very good professor of education, and had written a text for an illustrated book, I guess, about how to teach. And he claimed, unconvincingly, but he was so charming I didn't call him the liar. I think he was. That this was what the French would call épater la bourgeoisie, that they were sort of poking fun at the bourgeoisie and they were not serious. Well, I don't believe them. And at the time, I don't think anybody else did either, you know?
Okay. Well, thank you for that.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. That's an interesting, again, footnote. Can we turn down that phone noise, please? Anyway, we may take another caller or two. It's difficult during membership drive because we've got all the membership breaks as well. But we're going to go to another break in a few minutes here. I want to so this Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic that all these characters seem to converge at, I think it probably has a generally positive image in people's minds as a needed service, but it seemed to be more than just a free medical clinic. I know that Emmett Grogan from the Diggers, I believe you quote him, he had a didn't have a very positive view of the free. He basically said it wasn't quite free. You had to pay something. I forget what his quote was.
By being research subjects, because David Smith, no relation to Roger, but the medical doctor who opened the clinic. And you're right. I mean, it did provide free medical services to kids who really needed them, probably saved a lot of lives and helped a lot of kids. But what David wasn't honest about was he was getting government funding for sharing his research with the government and actually taking assignments from the government to research for them. Publicly, he said it was just a medical clinic, and he said there was no research being done there. That's easily disputed, and Emmett Grogan, who was in the community at the time and pretty well known, was the first one to make these charges. And it's interesting, my book came out June 26th, I think, or 5th, and about 3 weeks later they announced that the clinic was closing its doors after being open for 52 years.
And that's weird.
I have no idea if one has to do with the other, but at some point I'm going to make some calls about. I'm curious about the timing.
God, the resonances resonances and cross resonances are extraordinary.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're kind of leading up to again the circumstantial case. You know, I want to maybe ask you sort of a meta question eventually. Is, you know, you don't really try to offer your best case scenario for how you think plausible scenarios for how you think, you know, if indeed MK Ultra was involved in somehow experimenting with Manson, working with Manson, grooming Manson, I think is a phrase that I used with you. You assiduously avoid talking about that because as you say in your book, you're really trying to avoid, you know, falling down too many rabbit holes of quote conspiracy theory, and you want to stick to the actual documentary evidence, which I respect a lot. On the other hand, I get the feeling at the end of the book, I mean, I feel like I'm able, you know, and maybe that's what you're just challenging the reader to do, to just make up our own minds, obviously. Well, just say something about that.
Well, I mean, I'd be happy to say definitively what happened if I could, but honestly, I can't. And I feel like if I say, well, this is what I think is most likely to have happened, the minute I say that, I feel like I'm putting myself out there as claiming something happened in a conspiratorial way. I'd rather, just like you said, you drew your own conclusion by the end of the book, just show all the evidence I have that conflicts with the official narrative or creates a new narrative and let the readers reach their own conclusions. I mean, believe me, I've never stopped researching and working on this, and there's going to be something else coming along after this book with a lot of new information that I couldn't fit into the book and also have gathered since we actually finished writing the book in February. But I don't want to bias the reader's experience any more than you already do as an author, because again, if I really could say one way or the other what I thought happened, I would. Instead, I just can only say what I know didn't happen and what I know did happen that had never been reported. And that's what the book does, I think. You mentioned there's lots of ed notes, and if people want to see actually the documentation I have, there's some of them are reproduced in the book, but there wasn't enough room. So I have a couple websites, one Instagram and one Facebook, that have scanned documents of like the correspondence between Jolly West and Sidney Gottlieb, the head of the MK Ultra, correspondence between Roger Smith and the Federal Parole Office, for instance, requesting that they allow Manson to travel to Mexico and work in Mexico doing soil research in 1967 and or work as a musician at a hotel. I mean, this was completely unheard of because, number one, Manson's last arrest in 1961 was in Mexico. He was deported from Mexico when he was arrested with drugs and brought back to the United States, and then his parole that he was already on then was violated, as it should have been. And once someone's in Mexico, they can't be supervised. So I interviewed Roger. I actually liked him a lot. He's a very nice, smart man. But unfortunately, he couldn't explain that. He said he had no recollection of not only asking to send his client to Mexico to work, but also when he got turned down the first time, he wrote them again a second time asking them to reconsider this. And he said, "You're showing me these documents. Of course, I must have written them. I have no recollection why." And, you know, you'll encounter that a lot when you're interviewing people. At that point, I was interviewing him in 99, so that was 30 years after the murders.
Yeah, that I got to break in, finish your thought in after we come back. But there seems to be a lot of people who went to bat for Charles Manson in very strange ways. And we'll continue to talk about that as we continue to talk with Tom O'Neill, the author of Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s, getting a chance to hear Tom O'Neill, who does get on a few other outlets, but not all that many. I'm sure he also depends on community radio and public radio in general for talking about this. And you're still willing to do more interviews, which is nice. We really appreciate it. I know you have. Have you been on any? Have you been on like CNN or MSNBC? You've been on any of the big networks?
I've been on Michael Smirkanish's radio show, or I'm not sure what it is, but he did a big interview with me. He's a CNN journalist, but no, we haven't gotten. I guess NPR was really the only national TV outlet that did anything on us. We've gotten a lot of good national press, from newspapers and magazines.
Uh-huh.
But nobody is following up on a lot of the avenues I thought I opened with the book. I thought Los Angeles, particularly the Los Angeles Times, would be interested in interviewing some of the people I write about and make allegations against and seeing what they say, because there's still some people who are alive and pretty prominent, but they haven't done that.
Huh.
And also San Francisco, I thought the Chronicle might send some reporters to interview David Smith, Roger Smith, some other people who also have, a lot of new information that I report about them in the book, which I think, I would have been heard from lawyers if anybody took issue with the factuality of what I'm reporting. But I am disappointed that the national media hasn't done more as far as investigative journalism about my findings. But, maybe that's just my own small grandiosity or something. I did think it was important what I found out, but I think that there are still people in law enforcement that are covering up. And the last chapter of the book is about these Tex Watson tapes that the LAPD got through my efforts, but then didn't share with me in 2014 and refuses to release to the public. And they're really the first audio account of how and why the murders happened by the main killer, Tex Watson, to his attorney. And they're 50 years old. He's in prison for life. I have no idea why they won't release them to the public. And I do know a lot of the newspapers have made FOIA requests for them, and they get turned down.
Uh-huh. And he is a major figure. I'm not sure. I can't remember actually who he's called in the... Is he called by his name in the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I can't remember. I'm not sure that they did call him by his name.
But the figure
you do know who he is if you're familiar with the group when he goes up. I don't want to spoil it. I don't know how much
we
can talk about it if people haven't seen it yet. But it's up to you. It's your show, Paul. I'm happy to discuss it if you want.
Well,
but,
there's so much else to discuss. I just wanted to give a nod to that film.
Sure.
I thought it was. I was actually kind of, in a strange way, disappointed, I guess because I'm such a political person. I just felt like, I don't know, it seemed like such a sort of a Hollywood self-referential kind of thing. It seemed to be all about Hollywood and sort of its own sort of strange reckoning with the whole, in a weird kind of, I don't know. I found it a little odd myself, but...
Yeah, it was very entertaining. And then at the end, there's a twist, and I won't discuss it because I don't want to spoil it, but I had issues with that as well. The guy really knows what he's doing, and he's really good with detail, but you're right. I mean, they barely mention the politics of the time. I think you overhear a radio broadcaster saying something about a Vietnam War demonstration, but that all was just taken out of the background of the story, and I think it is important to know what the country was like in 1969 when these murders happened.
Well, we only have 10 minutes left, and there's like 2 hours worth of material to cover. I just wanted to quickly, before I forget, the Terry Gross of Fresh Air interview with Kinzer, I just want to get your impression a little bit on that. Did you hear that interview?
I did, yeah, I did.
Okay, because
she interested in his book.
She asserts in that interview, and I don't know if there's a mistake on her, but she says that the MK Ultra program ended in the early '60s, and I thought
it didn't.
And I know, and I thought that was really odd. That if it was a mistake, why that left it in there, and if it wasn't a mistake, if it couldn't have been intentional, I just thought that was odd. And one other thing, I'll get your impression on, is that she basically said, or he said, Kinzer, that there was no successful brainwashing assassin he basically kind of dismissed some of the stuff that you got deeper into when you looked at the actual research that Jolly West was doing, for example. So I don't know.
I'm glad you noticed that, Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my book was finished in March. It didn't go out to advance reviews and PR until about, I think, late April, early May. Now, his book was published about 3 weeks ago, so I'm pretty sure, I know he didn't have access to my stuff, so I'm giving him a break with that. I know that he didn't find the same documents I found. If he had, he would have changed his conclusion about them not being successful, because West very clearly reports that he was, and it was one of the most important things that they needed, which was to replace people's memories, true memories, with false ones without their awareness. That was one of the main objectives of the program. You know, I haven't gotten the book and read it yet, because once I do that, it's going to be a week of me making notes. But I did go to the index and just look at what he wrote about West, and he got all the stuff about West wrong. You know, he said he didn't start working for MKUltra until he was at Oklahoma in 55. He did some of his most important research from 52 to 55 at Blackman Air Force Base. And I don't know how he could get something wrong like that. You know, I don't know what. He's a New York Times reporter, but I think this is just really almost like an anthology of the program. There's not a whole lot of new reporting in there, as far as I could tell. And I think the New York Times review even mentioned that. It was a good review of the book, but at one point the reviewer said he wished there was more original reporting, you know, interviews with people who participated in this who are still alive, and documents. There was nothing that John Marks, who wrote the first and still definitive book about the program in 1977, The Search for the Manchurian Candidate, already had. So I don't want to knock another author, but I was disappointed.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm glad that my intuitions seem to be at least resonate, if not, you can't say confirmed. Anyway, so we only have a few minutes again left. Reeve Whitson, you're not going to be able to talk much about him, but he was a really shadowy figure involved in this narrative as well. Maybe just say a couple things about Reeve Whitson.
Yeah, you know, a name like that nobody had ever heard of, if you Googled him before my book, you would come up with old citations when he was involved in race car driving in the 60s and developing race car engines. But he was a shadowy, spooky guy who I learned about in the course of my investigation, who the CIA refused to release any records or even confirm or deny that he worked with them. But he was part of the police investigation of the murders. And before his death, I think it was 1996, he told his closest friends and his attorney that he had infiltrated the Manson family undercover in a program of the government. And his dying regret was that he could have prevented the murders, but didn't. And he also told several of these people who shared this with me that he had been to the Tate house after the murders had been committed, but before the police arrived and before the bodies had been discovered by the maid that morning. So there's a whole section on him and the compelling information I found out about him that adds a lot of weight to the hypothesis that Manson was being provoked and controlled and influenced by people who wanted him to basically destabilize the hippie movement by making them appear exactly as they appeared, as monsters.
No, wait, say that again?
That they wanted to destabilize...
Who wanted to?
The United States government. I mean, that was the purpose of COINTELPRO, the FBI program that you mentioned earlier, and CHAOS, the CIA program. They were two government programs designed to infiltrate and neutralize left-wing groups, anti-war groups, free speech groups, hippies, and black militant Black Panther groups. This all came out in 70s congressional hearings, and I believe Reeve Whitson was working for one of them.
Mm-hmm. And again, you get so tantalizingly close to the mythical smoking gun, but as you say, you came across so many documents, the Jolly West documents, mm-hmm. that he foolishly left some of that correspondence, as you say, with Gottlieb, that allowed you to get, you know, some of the only glimpse more directly mm-hmm. into some of this stuff, because they obviously shredded or burned or whatever all the MK Ultra stuff, or have them in deep freeze somewhere. Who knows?
No, they destroyed all the records mm-hmm. in 72. At the end of 72, Richard Helms, who was then the director of the CIA and supervised it with Sidney Gottlieb, ordered Gottlieb to shred everything. And that's why the only records that are out there were boxes of financial data that was in a warehouse that they had forgotten about. And it gives a little bit of an idea of like where the money went and who it was allocated to, but nothing about the experiments. The only stuff that has any description of that is the letters I found between West and Gottlieb.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to have to leave so much stuff kind of in the air, and just waiting for people to pick up a copy of this book, Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA and the Secret History of the 60s, which you can, for a minimum donation of 60. I'm sorry, I didn't get that straight, but you can call 877-500-5266 to pick up a copy of this book. And but I did want to, one last thing I just wanted to touch on. You know, again, you build a circumstantial case for, you know, what the background. You give sort of tantalizing hints about the way MK Ultra did do experimentation on how to like create a trained brainwashed assassin. They did want to discredit the various movements of the 60s, including the hippie counterculture. All this stuff, we know that we place Jolly West and Roger Smith and Reeve Whitson there, well, either in Los Angeles or in Haight-Ashbury. He started anyway. We got to go to a minute pitch break. Well, let's just finish this thought, and then we can end out the show talking to our listeners about why to support KBOO. So I won't ask you I kind of want to say it myself without asking you, So if there was some kind of grooming going on, if there was some kind of, working directly with Manson, what would have been some of the elements of that? You know, what was Manson doing to get so much, such blind obedience in his, quote, family?
You mean how was he accomplishing it, or what were other people doing?
That's a fine line. You don't want to get in there, but... Well, maybe we'll just have to leave that an open question for people, and they can.
I'll tell you one thing: if people can pressure the LAPD to release these tapes that Tex Watson made, I think all the answers to these questions are on those tapes.
Oh wow!
Eight hours of him describing 2 years of being with the family, what happened, who they were with, other murders that his own attorney told me he described on these tapes, murders of people who'd never been identified as victims of the Manson family. They're pretty important, and I believe that's why the LAPD has them in a vault and won't release them.
Okay. Well, that with that very tantalizing thought, that pressure the LAPD to release the Tex Watson tapes, we'll have to end our talk with the Tom O'Neill, author of Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s. And we look forward to whatever else you're going to come out with, Tom.
Thank you, Paul. I really enjoyed this.
Okay. Me too. All right. Thank you, Tom.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.